Life is 10% what happens to us and 90% how we respond to it. The right mindset is what separates most successful people from the average person. Changing your mindset can be one of the most valuable skills you can learn to help you create your own kick-ass life. Well, we want to help you begin that process today and give you a free copy of David Wood's training, Mindset, Your Key to Success. In this downloadable training, you'll learn how to develop a winner's mindset, how to overcome limiting and negative beliefs, how to love the word no, and much, much more. To download your free training, simply go to thekickasslife.com/free. That's thekickasslife.com/FRE.
Hi, this is Tim Ferriss, author of The 4-Hour Workweek, 4-Hour Body, and The 4-Hour Chef, and you're listening to David Wood on The Kick-Ass Life Show.
Make your life better?
This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Yes, it is. It is. It is. And I'm so glad to be back. You know, I just found out something last night. I had no idea about this because I was away in Africa. John Assaraf sat in for a show. I don't know if you listened to it or not. Great show. Just sat in for me. And, you know, that really is a testimony to the show. John's such a busy guy. And he's going to be a guest coming up in a week. And if you're interested in money at all, in the science of money and how you're wired and how you can change how you're wired to have financial success, you really want to listen to that show. But I am stoked as I hadn't had a chance to even speak to my producer. I was so busy when I got back. And and then I'm listening in there and I saw, oh my goodness, there's John, sits in, gets one phone call, and sits down, does a 30-minute show for the Kick-Ass Life. That, ladies and gentlemen, is really awesome. And Eric Coover, same thing, jumps in. Awesome guy, my brother from another mother. Just, again, deep gratitude for the people that stepped in, looked after things while my technology in Africa had gone walkabouts, as it were. So, yeah, really excited to be here. Got an amazing guest today, somebody I'm very, very fond of and spend time with a couple times a year in some beautiful places around the world. Again, just one of these real class acts, somebody who is making a really, really big difference in the world, and somebody who, when you meet him, there's something about him that is so rich and so deep, and you'll hear it in the chat. Anytime I chat with this guy, you kind of hear it. In fact, he does some incredible music, and I want you to listen to this.
We live in amazing times. We can build big buildings, invent the internet, send people walking across the moon, create fancy iPhones, keep breasts young forever, make vitamins to give you energy, and Viagra to keep it up, Prozac to keep it down. Build bombs to wipe out millions in a second. Launch 500 channels. Create complex car navigation systems. Invent new weight loss programs. Yet we still live in a world where children are starving. Millions are homeless.
This is from his work, Love Now. And he really does put some great messages together, which is so wonderful. Again, somebody who I'm really, really excited about. Before I sort of bring him on the show, I want to sort of just do a nice setup for him because, you know, one thing that I love about this guy is not just who he is and how he lives and how he impacts the world. It really is about his philosophies as well. And he'd grown up in a time and a place in the world that really had a very, very deep spiritual impact and a very, very deep impact on this young man's life. And you'll hear all about that as I ask him questions. I know that his story will unfold as we sit and chat. But one thing he does, which is something I'm going to be doing a lot more of with the Kick-Ass Life Adventure Club, he takes people on these trips and around the world, and really allows them to see behind the veil of their own understanding of self. And again, I wouldn't trust my students or my listeners with people that I didn't, that don't have this special quality that he does. And one of the things I'm going to ask him about, ask him to share with you about, is some of these trips he does, you know, India and Bali. And some of you know, I spent 3 weeks in Bali last year, and Bali is something that really affected me quite deeply, and affect me in a most beautiful way. And I don't know if you remember the stories when I was there. I recorded a number of shows from Bali. But there are some that they live with a karmic set of rules. And I think karma is really, it's a great way to live. If you believe that everything you did would come back to you, so any negative thing you did in the world would come back to you, and you would have to live through that negativity. I wonder if we would and double think and triple think some of the things we do and we say, whether we would gossip about people. I call it the whisper culture, where people, so afraid to tell the truth to someone's face, they'll often say things behind their back. And one of the things I really think kick-ass life practitioners think about is, and this comes out of their mouth, they'll say things like, well, you know what, the person isn't here, so I really don't want to chat about that until they are here. Or, this is something I have said or will say to the person, so I feel free to say it now, because there's nothing I'm going to say about this person that I wouldn't say to their face. And imagine if no one ever did that. So karmically, we knew that there was a price to pay for any time we were, consumed in gossip, or when we were saying things about somebody that wasn't there to defend themselves. And a great kick-ass life practitioner idea is that we would only talk about people as if they were sitting right next to us. And so that's one thing, how Bali seemed to work. But one thing, I'll tell you a quick story, and I've probably already told you this on the show, but this will give you an emphasis, because I'm going to ask Kurt about his trips into Bali. And the one thing that happened to me, I was riding bikes through down from Ubud, just through the countryside. I was completely, didn't know where I was at all, to be honest. And there were some farmers threshing rice on the side of the road. And interestingly, we pulled over on the bikes, went over there, and we spent about an hour and a half with them. And it was just beautiful. The whole village seemed to be there. And, people who were very, very poor in station would be sitting back behind the main threshers. And after they threshed the big stalks of rice, they would pass these stalks back to the poorest people in the village, which were these three very, very old ladies. And they had these little tiny knives, and they would knock off individual pieces of corn from the from the big stalks. And that's what they were going to live on that year. And so it was really beautiful to see. So I'd pretend to thresh this rice and hand these women these massive laden rice stalks. Anyway, so we had such a great time, and it was beautiful to be there. It was a great experience, and everyone was so open and friendly and giggly and whatever. Anyway, jump on the bike, and I'm about an hour away, and get a little tap on the shoulder. And somebody says to me, "Oh, you left this in the field." And I left my bag there. And interestingly, I found out how much these guys earn a year. And that was about 2 years' salary. And for the poorest people, it's probably more like 5 years' salary in that backpack. And, it was all there. And that's that karmic kind of way of living, is that, you can leave something somewhere in the middle of a field where people really are quite poor, and it will come back to you, because there's just no energy around around what some of the things we would see in other cultures. So, Bali is one of my favorite places in many, many ways, but certainly we had the most gorgeous trip there. And I took Jen on a journey into the unknown, which is my favorite journey to take, where you just step in every day into the unknown, let the unknown create the miracles and the magic. And so, you know, I really want you to think about what I'm going to ask Kute about, because you know, for some of you, you're ready for this kind of journey, and you know, he's a very, very special individual. And you know, if you want to find out more about that, you just go to thekickasslife.com/Kute, K as in kilo, U as in uniform, T as in tango, E as in echo, Kute. And if you want the show notes, by the way, you can go to thekickasslife.com/88. So thekickasslife.com/Kute, thekickasslife.com/88 for the show notes. And yeah, so I want you to listen in as I sit back and have a really great chat with my friend and somebody who's a true inspiration in the world and somebody who carries just a beautiful view of why travel opens up the heart and allows people to really step into a kick-ass life. So sit back, relax, and enjoy as I have a chat with my good friend, Kute Blackson. So, you know, here I go again. I always start the show the same way with this excitement I feel. Now, you know, and the excitement I feel today is really right down in my toes, because the guy that I've got coming on is someone I know. I fall in love with this guy. He's just an incredible soul on this universe doing incredible things. And I'm just so excited to have you on the show. So, Kute, hello, hello.
Hey, David, how are you, my friends? Great to be here.
I know. And you've been traveling all over again. You just got back. Tell us about your last trip. Where were you?
I was in Bali, I was in Thailand, I was in India, I was in Japan for a day, I was in Bali again, and I'm back in LA. So I'm not quite sure. I was walking through the streets of LA today in a meeting in Beverly Hills, and I'm like, this doesn't look like Bali. Where am I? You know, so it's walking between worlds.
Are you like me? One of my pet peeves is packing. Do you have anything around that, or do you love to pack?
I love to pack, David. I love airports, and I just love being on the move. I love sleeping on planes. I love it.
All right. Well, I love all the travel. I'm just not a big packer. But, you know, Kute, you know, you have an interesting background. And I remember the very first time we met, and it was in Hawaii. And you know, there's something very, very special about you. And there's an energy and a way of seeing the world. And there's a calmness and there's a kindness that oozes out of you. You know, and your background though, is from, East Africa, from Ghana, right?
Yeah. West Africa.
I'm sorry. West Africa. I apologize.
No problem. Yeah. I was born in Ghana, West Africa. My father's from Ghana. My mother's Japanese. I grew up in London from the age of 3. So I live in LA. I've been living in LA for the last 16, 17 years. So people ask me, where am I from? I always feel like I'm from everywhere and nowhere at the same time. And, you know, my first memories as a young boy, being around age 4, age 5, were literally two things, David. I remember around that age really feeling a deep sense of calling. I knew that my life was not my life. I knew that I was meant to be of service to a lot of people. And I just felt a calling to serve humanity. But also part of my background that's really influenced and shaped me now is, I remember, must have been about age 5 or 6, literally seeing a crippled woman walking on the sand in Ghana. And she was crawling on the sand, crippled. And I was this chubby little kid lost in the crowd. And I remember her picking up the sand that a man walked on, wiping it on her face and standing up. And it was like a miracle, you know. So I grew up seeing miracles. Blind people see, deaf people hear, people standing up have wheelchairs. This man would literally tell people, just stand up, you know. And basically this man was my father. So he's a healer and a minister and a mystic and has created 300 churches in West Africa of a kind of non-denominational, spiritual, new thought background. So I grew up in a very interesting environment, and through osmosis, learned a lot, started meditating at a very young age. So for me, spirituality and transformation and self-help and self-awareness has always been in my bones, been in my veins. You know, there wasn't really a moment when I begun or started. It just kind of was always there from the beginning.
I mean, and interestingly, like age 8, You were kind of like talking to congregations of like 300 people.
Yeah.
And 14, you were ordained. Is that right?
Well, what happened was, AJ, you know, I was the kid in my father's church. My father had a church in London where there were about 5,000 people every Sunday that would come to service. And he had one church in London at the time. And I remember being about AJ, and I was always that kid, you know, going to church. No kid really wants to go to church. And I was no different. And I would always play soccer with a tennis ball, you know, in the lobby and break everything. And finally, I got dragged into the front row of my father's church. And one day I was falling asleep, and my father announced to the congregation of 5,000 people that my son is going to be giving the sermon today. So I get thrown on stage, you know, unprepared, unannounced, having no idea. You know, when you're a kid, you just like run up the stairs. And I found myself on stage, and I kid you not, David, I literally looked down to the audience, and I don't remember what I said or what I didn't say, but I felt an energy come through. It was almost like feeling my destiny come through. I think we all have those moments where we feel like something else takes over. And I remember feeling that sense like something else took over and just came through me, and words came out my mouth and people started crying. And that, I would say, was, if anything, was the beginning of the conscious remembrance and awareness of why I was here. And it was a resonance in my being that I'll never forget. I can't remember the words or the content, but I'll never forget the feeling of, wow, this is why I was born, to spread a message, to share love, to share insight with people. And, you know, so what started happening was every month, unannounced to me, and I used to hate it as a kid, my father would just throw me up on stage and said, my son's going to be speaking today. And again, the same thing would happen. Words would come out my mouth and just people would be moved. And so when I was 14, and I started reading, you know, a lot of books by a lot of the greats, my father, you know, being a unique guy, had a huge library of thousands of books in his office. And even though him and I didn't speak a whole lot, I would just sneak into his library and start reading books by, you know, people like Shakti Gawain, Creative Visualization, Joseph Murphy, Ernest Holmes, the Eastern Mystics, Krishnamurti, Osho, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And I started devouring this information, and it just felt like I was remembering what I already knew. And I feel like there's a part of us that ultimately already knows everything, and we're just here to remember the truth of who we are. So when I was 14, again, unbeknownst to me, my father announces to the crowd that he says, my son's going to be taking over the ministry, and kind of I'm giving him the mantle to this organization, and he's going to be ordained next week. And I was like, okay. I looked across the stage at my mother. There's 3,000 to 4,000 eyes on me. And I guess, you know, I said yes. And I went along with it because, you know, David, I really felt a calling to make a difference. But, you know, I wasn't sure if it was supposed to be through the structure of religion, you know, the structure of church, even though my father's church is very spiritual, not kind of orthodox. But so I got ordained at 14. We had a big ceremony. It was a big deal. And, you know, then when I was 14, 15, a little after the ceremony, the ordination, I read a book by a man you probably have heard of called Krishnamurti. Mm-hmm. And I read Krishnamurti's book, and it was an internal explosion revolution. I think we all have those moments where something occurs for us, and the truth is revealed, a greater truth about who we are and about what we must do is revealed than before. And we know from that moment we cannot turn back. I knew when I read about Krishnamurti's life, and he talked about, I could really relate to his childhood and his upbringing. And he really talked about how a free mind is not a conditioned mind. A free mind is not a Buddhist mind, a Jewish mind, a Christian mind, an Islam mind. A free mind is free. And he talked about what is true freedom. And it just was this internal explosion. And from that moment, I knew I could not go back. From that moment, I knew that my path wasn't through the church or any kind of organized religion. I had to live with that for 3 years because I knew what I needed to do. And I think many of us know deep in our hearts what we need to do. We know the truth. We know we have a knowing, but we often don't follow it out of fear. We often don't follow it out of, you know, trepidation or what will happen to the lives we've created. And at that stage, I didn't want to lose my father's love. I didn't want to lose the relationship with my father. So for 3 years, I kind of quietly kept it inside. But when I was 17, you know, I chose not to go to university, which was a big deal in London growing up. And I had to have a conversation with my father. And I remember walking up the stairs to his bedroom, having to face my destiny and look him in the eyes and tell my father, "Dad, I love you, but I will not be taking over the ministry. I am retiring from the ministry at age, you know,
17.
I'm retiring." And that for me was a moment where I felt like I became a man, because I had to face the consequence where I knew that if I continued down the path of the ministry, which, you know, was a noble path, an amazing path, I felt like I would die. My soul, the essence for why I was born, would not be fully realized. And I knew I had to take the path into the unknown with no guarantees, the possibilities of losing, you know, my everything, you know, and my father and I didn't speak for years. But I knew that, sure, I could have everything, but if I don't have myself and my truth, I have nothing. And I kind of chose the path of the unknown. And cut a long story short, I won a green card in the lottery and came to America with two suitcases, $1,200 in my pocket, one suitcase full of books, one suitcase full of clothes, and following a dream, following my soul.
You know, I want to ask you a little bit about your dad, because, I mean, you said you didn't speak after the sort of the separation, but before that, it sounded like, you know, that there was, I mean, this man was busy, 300 churches. I mean, you talk about seeing really seeing miracles and things happening around him. What was the relationship like? When you were growing up, were you close, or were you just sort of?
Yeah, my father, you know, is an amazing man. Don't get me wrong. He was amazing then. He's amazing now. And now him and I are really close, and there's a lot of love there. Growing up as a child, you know, especially at that time, my father was very old school, very, you know, he wasn't a man on a human level I was very close to as a child growing up. Number one, he was gone all the time. His entire life was about being of service to humanity, and he was totally surrendered and dedicated to that. So I didn't see a whole lot of him. And when I did see him, you know, I didn't know him. So there was always this sort of, who is this man? And yet I loved him and worshipped him as this sort of icon. You know, he's like I call him an African Sai Baba, you know, a healer, a Siddha yogi, so to speak. But he had these churches. So we weren't very close as kids. But, you know, that's why it was really hard, because I didn't want to disappoint him. I didn't want to lose his love. I didn't want to lose his validation and approval. And I think that so often many of us, we compromise the truth of our hearts. We compromise the depth of what we know. We compromise really following our path in the most raw and real and radical and authentic way, because we're afraid of losing love. We're afraid of losing the validation. We're afraid of losing acceptance, you know, and that's how it was with my father. As a child, I just wanted to be loved by him, and we weren't close, but we've grown to be very close now. And I think over the years, there's a tremendous love there. And I think he's grown to, you know, respect who I've become and what I'm up to and my vision right now. And it's really gratifying knowing that the peace in my heart, in knowing that I was willing to lose everything to not compromise my soul's expression and the truth of my soul, even though him and I didn't speak for years and it was painful on one level, I knew that the pain of compromising my soul and my deeper truth would have been even more painful than losing my father, you know. So that was the piece for me.
Yeah, and so as I look at that sort of, you know, this relationship evolving, and we look at you as a young boy seeing, I want to touch on this miracle thing only because, you know, the show's in 154 countries, and in many countries when you say that, they get it, they understand exactly what you're talking about and they hear it. In other countries, the skeptic, that judgment mind kicks in. Oh, this is all woo-woo, this is beer, you know. So I want us to talk about that, because I mean, again, you know, when you talk about miracles and you see things, how do you see a miracle today, and what does that mean to you really?
I think, well, it means different things to me. First, let me make clear, you know, I understand that when I say I saw miracles, you know, we often see these miracle guys on TV and we wonder, is that real? What's really happening? What I just want to clarify is, you know, I was an 8, 10-year-old, 14-year-old kid. I saw it day in, David, and day out, literally people coming in wheelchairs, and my father would literally, let me just kind of clarify what happened. He'd look at them and he'd say, stand up of the wheelchair. And they would say, well, I'm sick. And he would say, stand up. And he would say, they would say, I'm sick. And he would say, do you believe? Do you believe in the words of Jesus and the words of the great ones? Do you really have faith in the infinite? And they would say, yes. Then he'd say, well, then why are you sitting down? And they would look at him and go, well, I guess you have a point. And they would stand up. And it was a miracle. And I think on one level, a miracle is a shift in awareness, a shift in perception. A miracle is when you really see the reality of reality itself and align with that. And miracles to me aren't something you have to create with a mantra or a formula. Miracles are what's going on and happening all the time. That if anything, you know, I think what's sad for me growing up with that sense of everything is possible, nothing is impossible, is that is how in the West, and just the scientificness of the West, we've been conditioned out of that infinite possibility. We've been conditioned into the limitation of the mind and how this is not possible and that's not possible, and everything has to be simply based on what you see.
I don't want to interrupt you there, but you're thinking of Einstein, you know, wasn't it him that said, you know, there's two ways of looking at life. One way is whether nothing's a miracle. The other way is if everything's a miracle, right?
Everything, you know, everything, literally. So I think there's so many different levels and dimensions, David, of awareness, of existence. We see the physical, but everything is atoms swirling at different vibrations. Everything is frequency. Everything is energy moving, but we see the physical. And I think the ability to tap into that deeper dimension of feeling energetic, there the miracle's already happening. So to me, that's one level, but ultimately, beyond this, you know, beyond the blind seeing and the deaf hearing and the crippled walking, just what I realized after leaving the church is that's great and those are miraculous things. But, you know, just breathing is a miracle. Just being able to look around and see the different colors of life is a miracle. Just feeling the intricate universes inside of your body, my body, right now, as we are talking, to be able for me to give a voice and you to hear me and all the processes that happen in your brain right now and the blood that's flowing through your veins right now and trillions of, you know, communications that are going on inside of each and every one of us right now, to me, that's miraculous. So essentially, the simplicity of this moment, if we really allow ourselves to bring our awareness to what's going on right now, each moment, just to be even alive, it's a miracle. We're all a miracle. Everything's a miracle. And to feel that, for me, is what's amazing. So we don't have to look very far. We don't have to go to the Himalayas, although it's amazing. We don't have to, you know, look for people that are blind and have them see. Just this moment is enough. You know?
Yeah, you know, it's really funny. Many of my events, I'll ask that question. I say, guys, would you like to see a miracle? You know, and you see the people, you know, skeptical or like leaning forward, and there's a look of wonder in their eye. And I ask them just to put their hand up in front of their face and bend their finger and look at it and appreciate the miracle that they are, right? And what it takes to have that happen. And I think that, you know, that the way that you express your humanity in every moment, and I watch you when we've hung out, when we're playing, when we're goofing off, or when we're, you know, as a student, as a teacher, you know, you truly sort of, you live life as if it's a miracle, and it's really beautiful to see. But, you know, if I take you past this story, then you've left the church, you've arrived in America, you've got this $1,200, you've got two suitcases, but you've got this conviction, and you've got this understanding of a calling that's higher and bigger, and then you discover your own processes, and it leads you to, well, I think you call it, was it liberated living? I think, is that what it's called? Do you want to talk about that a little bit? What happened for you as you sort of stepped out on your own?
Well, in a nutshell, what happened for me was I came full of passion to the West, to America in pursuit of the American dream. And I came to LA because, you know, all the authors I'd been reading about lived in LA, and I wanted to find the teachers and the mentors, many of which you know, many of which you're friends with, many of which everyone knows, and many of which people have never heard about. And I went and studied with them and learned from them and, you know, got to know some of them and got to hang out with some of them and just, you know, got to receive a lot of beautiful experiences and insight and wisdom. And through that process, though, what happened for me really was I fell in love with an amazing woman at that time. And, you know, relationship tends to just crack the heart open. And you can theorize about stuff, you can intellectualize about stuff, and when you dive into a relationship and open your heart, the relationship tends to bring up everything that's unresolved, unlike itself, in order to be healed. And that's really what took me on a deep dive at a very young age, I must have been about 21, on a deep dive over the next 5 years to look at the aspects of myself that weren't healed, to look at those parts of myself that were unresolved with my father, to look at the human dimensions of myself, the fear, the anger, the resentment, the guilt, the shame, the stuff that I wasn't even consciously aware of and was kind of doing a spiritual bypass on, to really heal those parts of myself so I could become a fully integrated being and not have those, you know, those unresolved aspects kind of pull me down. So I went on a quest and a journey to really finding out who I was, really finding out the real me. And from there, I started traveling, traveled to India, traveled to Thailand, traveled, walked the Camino in 900 kilometers in Spain, and just went on a spiritual quest in search of answers, answers of why we're here, who are we, what are we. And one of the things that really lived to liberate living and led to what I do now was I end up sitting in a room for close to 5 or 6 months, barely leaving, journaling, crying, writing, feeling all those things I had maybe suppressed. You know, as children, I believe, David, as children, we're born, you know, for the most part, there's a freedom. We're not so conditioned. If you look at kids, there's a, you know, we're in touch with our essence. As children, kids are in touch with that radiant glow, that radiant essence of their own infinity and divinity. But then as we go through life, we kind of get a little conditioned. We get conditioned to, you know, we learn all sorts of ways to shut down, to disconnect, to not feel, so that we don't have to feel the pain, the trauma, the shame, the guilt, the, you know, the fear. And we start learning ways to disconnect and not feel that hurt and that stuff. But we also start learning a mechanism, a strategy, a way of being in the world to be validated, to get loved, kind of like, who do I need to be in order to be loved? And we start developing a mechanism, we start developing layers and patterning, oh, that covers up the true essence of our real authentic nature. So for me, it was a process of really peeling away those layers. And I say, to the degree that we're conditioned, is we often think we have free will, but we often don't realize that to the degree we're conditioned, we're really not that free. So what I had to go through, that I teach people and take people through, is, you know, how to really peel away the conditioning, peel away the layers that have maybe built up, covering up our true selves. And, you know, we develop this character, this identity over time that, you know, we've developed to survive and to function. And we often think that this is who I am. This is just me, you know, this kind of five-step pattern that we've learned to do over 5, 10, 15 years. It worked for us when we were 5. It worked for us when we were 10. But we may still be doing that limited version of ourselves when we're 20 and 30 and 40 and 50. And at a certain point, it ends up limiting our full expression. So I went through my journey at quite a young age of having to face that and dismantle who I thought I was and who I became in order to just make it, in order to survive. And it helped me, you know, succeed at quite a young age, but also there were so many limitations that it had in terms of opening and intimacy and connection and relationship. So as I started unraveling and peeling away the layers, I went through a profound transformation to really connect with and ask myself the question, who am I? Who am I really? Am I this? Am I my thoughts? Am I this character that I've created myself to be? Who am I really? And I think that's one of the most important questions we can really ask ourselves. And as I started to peel away the layers and went deeper and deeper and deeper, it was as though getting in touch with the truth of my being that wasn't dependent on anything outside, that wasn't dependent on the comings and goings, the changing thoughts or beliefs or emotions, but there was an unchanging something at the depth of my being that was never touched, that was never scarred, that was always pure, always free, always unconditioned. So for me, liberated living is really reconnecting with who we truly are, that pure essential nature. And then from that place, moving into the world, creating in the world, living in the world from that place rather than ego, you know? So for me, that's what it's about.
Sure. And you talk about free fall as well, right? Once you've sort of got through that preconditioned programming, you know, life becomes, you know, just juicy and do it. Just describe before, I want you to take us on a journey with you, like, because I know you use the world as a canvas so often in the work you do. And I understand why. And it's really embedded in the story you've just shared. But just talk a little bit about what free fall means to you.
Free fall is, you know, kind of what I was saying was, it's almost as though growing up, we develop a certain persona, a certain strategy, a certain way to avoid pain, a certain way to be loved. We learn, oh, if I'm this way, if I'm funny, if I'm nice, if I'm sweet, if I'm aloof, if I'm this way, then I don't have to get hurt. Oh, if I'm this way, then people love me. If I'm that way, then, you know, my parents won't you know, abandon me. If I'm not that way, then my friends like me. And before you know it, as kids, unconsciously, we start learning a kind of, I call it a kind of dance. Let's just say it's a 5-step dance rhythm. Oh, I do this, I do this, I do this.
The survival dance.
It's the survival dance. And we start holding on to that way of being. And we often think, this is who I am. Right. But we don't realize that it only, that 5-step rhythm, there's not that much fluidity and flexibility in those preset patterns that we've developed to function and survive. Now we only have like 5 gears. So that no matter what music plays, whether this is metaphor, obviously, whether it's reggae, whether it's, you know, samba, whether it's tango, whether it's hip hop, whether it's, you know, pop music, no matter what the music, we can only do this preset 5-step rhythm called me, called myself. So there's not much flexibility in terms of really feeling the moment and meeting the moment spontaneously, moment to moment to moment. We only have 5 gears. Free fall is as we start unconditioning ourselves, as we start feeling and releasing and letting go, we start to realize, wow, maybe there's 6 steps, maybe there's 7 steps, maybe I don't have to do that thing. Maybe I don't have to be that way. Maybe I don't have to react that way anymore. Maybe I don't have to disconnect in that way. And we start to expand the range of our capacity to move, to groove, to feel. We start to expand the range of our ability to respond rather than be defensive. We start to expand the range of our ability to live. And free fall is when we're really able, rather than living life based on, you know, 5-step default patterns, is to really live life spontaneously. Is to start to really, as we let go and not know who we are. So many people say, you have to know who you are. Well, on one level, yes, know who you are. But on another level, the willingness to not know who you are so you can find out who you really are. Free fall is when you let go and spontaneously kind of merge with the moment beyond the mind, beyond the conditioning. And in that moment, it's kind of like feeling how the moment itself is seeking to express and live you beyond the ways you can imagine. And each moment and what you end up doing and expressing and saying often doesn't come from your conditioned patterns of the past, but arises from the moment, where you may not know what you're going to do in the moment. I'm sure you've had moments on stage, David, where, you know, you didn't use the script, or you just were, just for a moment, you were gone and just stuff came out of you that you look back and go, wow.
So actually, so many times when I'm working with an audience where I feel it's almost like I'm a part of everything, a part of everyone in the room. Yes. I know I can sense and feel it. It doesn't matter if it's a big room of thousands of people or just a few hundred people, but I almost have a sense of every single person in the room. But I suppose it's like completely letting go and surrendering into that moment. And that sort of brings me up into the sort of when I and again, you know, I've heard your story from you, and I just have so much deep respect and love for who you are and who you are in the moment and the presence that you have. It's such a rare thing. So, you know, as someone's listening in, it doesn't matter where you're listening in around the world right now, I want you to this journey, and Coot, you know, you talked about this, you know, leaving with these two suitcases. You talked about, you know, going on this spiritual quest. And I look back into my own story, and I realized that one of the transformations for me was when I left England sort of accidentally, and I ended up on this 10 and a half year backpacking trip around the world where I was terrified for a year and a half. I mean, I was absolutely terrified of everything. And suddenly, as I got more familiar with the unknown, as I stepped into and fell in love with the unknown and allowed that space to occur, which I believe is exactly what you're talking about. And where I want to lead you right now is this work that you do, this transformational immersion journeys that you take people on, where you take people on a journey into countries around the world where they can step into this with you as a guide and have this same experience that's opened up and transformed in you and I the same wonder of the world, the same connection with people, that same joy of living, that same understanding of calling and purpose. And so talk to us a little bit about how you came up with this idea to take people out of the comfort zone of their lives and step them into this miracle of a journey that you create.
Yeah, sure. You know, it really came out. The seed was planted, David, when I started traveling. And, you know, I really started traveling intensely about 13 years ago. I went to India. You know, I reached a place in my life where, you know, I had a certain level of success and had a radio show, a nice girlfriend. And life was, you know, moving along. I thought, this is great. You know, I'm kind of, you know, attaining what I thought I wanted. And something was not quite fulfilling. Something wasn't quite aligned. And I decided that I was tired of reading the books. I was tired of reading about God. I wanted to know God for myself. I wanted to know what true happiness was for myself. So I put everything in storage, and I started traveling. And I found myself in India. And that's when it really, really began, where I remember being on the back of a train in India, in the poorest state in India, in the poorest town in India, in the poorest train station in India. And I was on the back of a train for about 7 hours in the third class section of this train. And I remember being on this train and I was stuck with the poorest people like a sardine can, you know, it was so crowded. And I looked into this woman's eyes, and that's where it began, because I looked into her eyes and my heart just wept for hours, because I felt the suffering of humanity. Like, wow, we live in a world where, you know, we can send people to the moon, but we can't feed people. And my heart cracked open because I just cried, you know, I just wept. And then a few hours later, I looked into the same woman's eyes, who had five kids and they were all kind of sick. And I thought, wow, we've forgotten about these people, our brothers and sisters. But then I looked into her eyes and I felt, as she looked into my eyes, I looked into her eyes. The same thing that was looking at me was what was looking at her. And I felt this oneness. I felt like we were one. And it was like my heart then opened as love, because I felt the separation dissolve between us. And I thought in that moment, wouldn't it be amazing if leaders, if people that wanted to have an impact on the planet, on the world, were on this train with me, like, you know, the head of Google, the head of Nike, a president, you know, how, as a result of their transformation, how would they transform their lives? How would they then use that new awareness to transform cultures? And I forgot about it for years. And over the, you know, last 10 years, I've built a very successful coaching business and work with people from all walks of life. But what specifically happened was 6 years ago, I was meditating very deeply and as to the next expression of my work and the next level. And in my meditation, I got the vision, create that journey. And then I remember that journey on the train. And I thought, wow, who's going to do that? Basically, the journey became, the first level of the journey became what I call the liberation experience, where I take a visionary or a high-level, you know, leader or individual who has a vision of having an impact. I take them to India and I take away your money, your passport. You have a backpack, a pair of clothes, and you have no idea where you're going. And you're stuck with me for about 13 to 14 days. It's a no-holds-barred, 24/7 radical, intensive, experiential immersion journey where I feel into where your deepest limitations are, your deepest fears are, the deepest places where you might be holding on to that might be limits on you expressing yourself fully. And I customize and I create a profound process that really is designed to free you up, that's designed to feel into all those parts of you that may not be free and really just move you into that next level of freedom and expression. We're on planes, we're on trains, we're in the Himalayas and the Ganges and the biggest slums in Asia, meeting with gurus. And it's, you know, it's an intense, intense journey. Over the last 6 years, I've done 19 of those journeys. I do 3 a year. And what started happening also was, you know, it's funny because halfway into it, about three, four years ago, people started asking, are you going to create a group trip? And I thought, I don't know if I want to create a group trip to India, but what started happening also was I went to Bali and cut long story short, David, I created a journey that I've been doing for the last year and a half, 2 years, called Boundless Bliss, that's inspired by the journeys to India, and where I invite 20 leaders from around the world. And we had people from about 8 countries come together, and really special journeys. Again, experiential immersion. It's like a seminar training without walls, where I use Bali as the backdrop. And essentially what I believe is when you, you know, we have all these things that we hold on to, you know, my name, my fame, my house, my wife, my relationship, my bank account, you know, and we think we're free, but the moment you take away someone's cell phone, or the moment you take away someone's iPad, the moment you take away someone's clothes, the moment you know, we all are holding on to certain things tightly that we might be identifying as, this is who I am. So what I do is I first and foremost ask people to surrender, and I take away those foundational things that you might be identifying to as to, this is me. And then we look at the deeper level of, what are the internal things, emotional belief systems, patterns that you might be holding onto and identifying as a sense of who I am? And I take all those away so that we can really ultimately find out who is the you that remains when all that's taken away? What's left? So that you can really find out beyond what changes. So the question becomes, who are you really? And my immersion journeys, whether it's in India, it's one-on-one, whether it's in Bali with the group, is all about that deep question, experientially finding out, who are you really, 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 really? So I put people in situations, I create situations, put people in situations that really push them up to their edges and move them through what they think is possible and who they think they are, so that they're forced to really access the freedom inside, not a freedom that's dependent on the externals, because when our freedom is dependent on the externals, everything in the external world is constantly changing, is temporary, is impermanent, is transitory. So when our freedom is based on those things, then our confidence and our sense of power will also fluctuate. But when we really tap into that zone that Mandela tapped into, even though he was in prison for 27 years, he was free inside of himself. To me, that is power. So these journeys are really about assisting people in tapping into that unchanging presence, knowing beingness inside that is not dependent on anything outside. And to me, that's real power. You know, so that's a little.
No, it's excuse me. That's awesome. You know, and I was in Bali last year. I think you and I I think we were there at the same time because we saw each other just after that. You know, and there is something very, very magical about that. I mean, of all the countries I've traveled, there is something so very, very beautiful about the country itself. And I've often thought, since you told me about these trips that you're doing there, and the wonder of that journey, I wonder if you can share with me, you know, what is the what have you seen? Like, you just got back from a journey like this where you take a group. What is give us a kind of a sense of and without giving anything away, because I know you can't give anything away, but give us a sense of the transformation that someone goes through. Is it day 4? Is it day 5? Are you seeing things? Are you seeing that people hanging on till day 12? Yeah. What are you seeing a lot?
First, let's get clear that let's just get clear on one thing. When I created the India journey and the Bali journey, what I was told and guided to right up front, and this kind of is a piece of your question, so I have to kind of just express this, is what I was told in my meditations were, there are souls that are destined to do the journey. and they will know when it's for them. They will just know it's their destiny. So I really trust that those souls that know, the moment they hear about it, begin a process. So the real transformational process doesn't even begin when they get to Bali. It starts kind of before, and then when they go to the website and then they start reading about and watching the video, the process begins then, because they start connecting with what's already a part of their destiny. And I've set up the process where only those that truly are committed get to go. But I set up the process where there's a whole bunch of steps that occur before someone even gets to Bali, to filter people out, but also to put people through a process of surrender before they even get there. So what we often hear before people even get to Bali is, wow, my life has changed before I even got here. But what starts happening is, you know, I start dealing with some of the foundational core patterns of conditioning, most of which we're not even aware of consciously, most of which we're not even seeing consciously. The eyeball often can't see itself. So the first part of the journey in Bali is really creating an experiential immersion process where I guide people through a intensive process of seeing the stuff they're not aware of about themselves, seeing the conditioning that perhaps they weren't realizing was limiting them, was inhibiting them, was blocking their free expression, the unconscious, the unaware. And I help them start to clear that in a very deep way, to release that, to facilitate the moving through those blockages in a really powerful way. And, you know, I think each person has their breakthroughs at different parts. I kind of say no one can go through this journey in Bali and come out the same way. Like, you will not come out alive, because it will meet you wherever you are in your own process. And it's magical, you know. And Bali is the seminar room itself, the backdrop, so to speak, to provide the lubrication and the grace that allows layers to wash away. It's that Bali is that divine feminine magic that that heals the heart. You know, when I take people to India, India's magical, but India just confronts you with your stuff. Bali, you don't even realize what's happening, but just layers peel away in that grace, in that essence, you know, in that feminine nature. And transformation happens just by being in that presence. She's like this graceful, beautiful woman that just lifts layers, you know, when past karma. So it's an amazing journey. It's a unique journey. And we have about 21 people that come on this, you know, thrilling adventure of the heart. And it's kind of like, you know, Bali is not just a geography, it's a state of being. And my vision is to remove whatever the layers are and blockages so that people can experience the Bali inside of themselves. You know, I customize processes and what have you, but it's an ultimately, the real pilgrimage, David, is not to temples and mountains and places. The real pilgrimage I take people on is a pilgrimage inside, to the parts of yourself that may have been suppressed, to the internal cave that you may have hidden from and been afraid to see, is to the mountaintop of your own consciousness that maybe you didn't think you could rise to. Because as we start accessing more of who we are, then not only do we access more of who we are, we get to express more of who we are, we get to express more of our true gifts. And I believe, and the reason I've created any of these journeys, is I believe that the reason we're here ultimately is not simply to achieve fame or material goals or money or to accumulate, because at the end of our lives, we can take none of this stuff with us. None of the accolades, none of the Grammys, none of the bank account, none of the cars, none of the homes. We take none of it with us. Not even Tutankhamun took his gold with him. Ultimately, at the end of our lives, all we get to take with us is the evolution of our being, the evolution of our souls, and the degree to which we recognize and realize our true nature. To me, this is the real wealth. This is the real riches that we are born to inherit, born to realize, so to speak. So this is what the journey is about, helping people, you know, access that, but also not just access that internally and just kind of lounge around, but part of my vision is to then assist each person to, because I believe that we all have a gift, no matter who we are, whether we're black, white, green, tall, you know, Ivy Leagues, education, no education. Each and every one of us has a unique gift that we are born to give. We're encoded with it. We may not be aware of it. We may not be conscious of it, but we have a gift that we're born to give. And it's about assisting people in giving that gift radically.
That's so great. You know, we're almost out of time, and I do want to just let people know, because I can see that there are people who are ready, Coot, that want to come on this thing with you, at least take that next step. So if they go to thekickasslife.com/bliss, so thekickasslife.com/bliss, you'll be able to meet Coot there and continue on this journey with him. And Coot, you know, the show is called The Kick-Ass Life.
Yes.
And I'm fascinated by your interpretation of what a kick-ass life really is. I mean, obviously, I think I have a deep sense of what you're going to say, but I'd love you to articulate with your beautiful language and your beautiful expression, you know, what is a kick-ass life?
Yeah, well, you know, on one level, I say kick-ass life is a kick-ass life. You know, you said it's just your phrase hits it on the head. To me, a kick-ass life ultimately is really living in touch with your true heart, living in touch with your true being, and giving that and playing full out and giving that as fully, as radically, as authentically as possible with no regrets. I often say, look, there's no refunds in life. You can't go to God at the end of your life and say, hey, God, yo, please, you know, I didn't live it full out. Can I get a few days back? Ultimately, we never know when that moment's going to come. We never know when the great one will call us back. I often ask people, one of my favorite questions is, you know, what if today was the last day of your life? Are you ready? Are you ready to go? Are you ready to throw your arms wide open and say, yes, take me, I'm ready, I'm giving everything. To me, a kick-ass life is when moment to moment to moment, you are ravishing the moment, giving everything to everything as everything, because there's nothing else to do, so that when that moment comes, you have no regrets whatsoever. And I would say to those listening, if you can't say, I'm ready right now, take me because I'm giving everything, then what would you need to do to rearrange your life so you could say that? Who would you need to forgive? What would you need to express? What would you need to give so that each moment you are ready to die? Because I believe that if every moment you're ready to die, then you're truly alive. Not that you will die, but that then you're truly living, you're truly alive with no regrets whatsoever. I would then encourage everyone, say, hey, once you're done reading, once you're done listening to this interview, once you're done meditating, once you're done, you know, fasting, once you're done doing yoga, Kundalini yoga, Hatha yoga, once you're done jogging, running, you know, doing Reiki, once you're done reading the Bhagavad Gita, the question to me in terms of living a kick-ass life is, are you loving fully or are you not? Because at the end of our lives, I think what we're going to ask ourselves is, did I love radically? Did I love fully? Did I give everything I had to each moment? And to me, that's a kick-ass life. No matter whether you succeeded by conventional terms, whether you achieved the goal that you thought you needed to achieve, whether you did that thing, whether you made the amount of money or material stuff that you thought you needed to have, to me, that's not the purpose of life. It's, did I live with great integrity? Did I live in alignment with who I truly was? Was I authentically who I was? And do I have no regrets? And I think if we can say that, it's a kick-ass life, man.
Well, you know, on that, I'm just going to remind people, thekickasslife.com/bliss, BLISS. And that's what you want to be, is with this gentleman living blissfully. Hey, Coot, we're going to see each other in a week down in St. Martin with the sand between our toes. And I'm looking forward to hanging out and catching up.
Let's have a blast. Let's have a blast. It's been a real joy, David. Thank you for your heart and just generosity and just love to you, my friend.
All right. See you soon. So you up for a challenge? You know, it's again, I want you to already think about this. If it's your time and you're ready for that trip into the unknown, I want you to check him out, right? And understand that this is a rare, very, very rare individual, somebody who really, truly has such a special place in the world. And, you know, they come along every now and again. and they see the world through a lens that is so pure. And yet, this guy is so down to earth and so easy to hang out with, and such a real light, I suppose, is a without being too woo-woo here. So don't forget the Kickass Life /Coot, or if you want the show notes, the Kickass Life /88, which is the number of the show. And yeah, I just want to thank you for listening in, and I really think about these simple messages, and say simple. They are simple to hear, and yet sometimes incredibly challenging to step into and live moment to moment. And I really think, you know, as Kick-Ass Life practitioners, we start stepping into a world that is very simple, because when we live by a sort of a truth, and when we live with a karmic view on the world of everything we do is like a boomerang, it's going to come back to us. And every good thing, and we don't do the good to get the reward at all. But what happens is, you know, we do the good as it's just something that is always in front of us. There's always the consciousness that there's a chance to reach out and help. There's a chance to lift someone's spirit. There's a chance to connect on a deep, rich level, as if you've met someone or you've known someone your whole life, and you only have met them for a couple of minutes. And that's something that you know, you become a master of once you start really living these principles, is that idea of a deep, rich connection. And you know, one of the philosophies I really love is like trusting 100%, 100%. Everyone, trust them all. Trust everyone 100%. And give people benefit of the doubt and live that way. And if trust is broken, then check into it and see if they need a second chance. Because, you know, how many times have you broken trust? How many times have you said you're going to do something, you don't do it? How many times have you, you know, you told lies? Or how many times have you broken trust with self? You know, you said you're going to go to the gym, you don't. And so knowing that people are just human, imagine that you can give people a couple of chances and you can face truth with them and let them know that you've kind of seen through that, but give them a chance, keep trusting. And I think that I understand that what I've discovered is that when we really start to trust and we live that way, and I think it was Einstein that said, you got to live as if, you either live as if nothing's a miracle or as if everything's a miracle. When we treat everyone as if they're a miracle, what I find truly is that the best just comes out. And when they make mistakes, if you don't take it too personally and you realize that we all make mistakes, and you give them a chance, the second time they're much more reluctant to step over that line, and they really feel that there isn't this burden they have to carry for the rest of their life, you know? And again, I do that by looking in the mirror and asking myself these questions. Have I done this? And I've made every mistake. I've told every lie. I've crossed every line. So yeah, it's easier for me to do this. But what happens if you can do it? Anyway, so again, if you're ready for this big adventure, then trust. Just go into this with absolute trust that this could be the thing that changes your life forever. And yeah, I will definitely see you on the other side. And I can't tell you how great it is to be back in my studio talking into this microphone and knowing that around the world, I haven't even checked how many countries. It was 154 when we left, but who knows now? But I'll see you on the other side. Sending love out there.
That was kick-ass.